opened up the Bin Laden Task Force in late 1995, early 1996, and I was the senior operations officer in the unit. And we planned and we proposed, we had Bin Laden in our sights in the mid-90s to the point that we knew what car he drove, where he drove it, bodyguards. And we kept putting proposals for taking him out. I mean, by taking him out, I don't mean just shooting him. I'm saying we could have gone in there and captured him and brought him out because we knew what he was doing. He was building terrorist camps. He was bringing in Chechens and all kinds of really radical individuals. We had years of that. And how many years later were we able to get Bin Laden himself when we, you know, found out where he was and got our SEAL team guys to shoot him in the face? So, you know, some of them take the span of years.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Before we get to my guest this week, real quick, if you don't mind, if you haven't done it already, go to Apple and review my podcast and give it a good review, please. That would really help. 5 stars would be appreciated if you like it. If you don't, then don't go and ignore this. But would appreciate getting some nice reviews. We got a whole bunch, but it always helps to have more. So just go to Apple and buy my podcast and hit 5 stars and say nice things. Anything you want to say. And that was Rick Prato, by the way, my guest this week, talking about the inner workings of the CIA Black Ops operation. He's an officer in the CIA, and that was about Bin Laden and how long it took from the time they really started tracking him to actually getting him. It's just a really cool conversation with somebody that you rarely get to talk to about and hear about, a world that you rarely get to hear about, which is Black Ops. So I'm really excited about this conversation. Rick has a book out, so I hope you enjoy that. And please spread the word about the podcast to your friends. And before we get to the full interview, I've been noticing that there are a lot of these beds that are like sleep number beds. You know, I got a friend who's got a bed that can actually, it actually moves up, but will like prop you up when you start snoring, like these smart beds, or you adjust a number and the bed is exactly what you want it to be. It's all well and good. You know, it's all for a good night's sleep. You want to know, you know how I'm going to get a good night's sleep? If I have a bed, not that has all those fancy doodads or whatever, just a bed that can deal with the problems that keep me up at night. Like maybe a bed that can the HVAC company that put in my furnace and then refuses to come and fix it when it's only 6 months old. Or slap anybody who reads an email and then writes back to you in an email, clearly having not fully read the email, and asks you questions that you have to respond to with the in the email that in which you just responded to. All right, I'm already getting agitated. You understand what I'm saying, okay? So if we can have a bed that can deal with that, or maybe a bed that can basically just fire anybody that works for you who's incompetent and refuses to take direction and keeps making the same mistake over and over again. Charlie, you know who I'm talking about right now. Anyway, just a thought. That would be a great bed. I would sleep well at night if it could handle my problems for me. All right. Enjoy Rick Prato. And please go review the podcast and tell friends about it, too. Always want to spread the word. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. My guest this week, lifelong CIA operative Rick Prato, joins me for a book that he's got, Black Ops, The Life of a CIA Shadow Warrior. Black Ops is the story of Rick's legendary career. It spanned 2 eras, Cold War and the Age of Terrorism. And it's a really fascinating behind the scenes look, behind the curtain look at what Black Ops is all about and what this amazing work that folks like Rick have done to keep America safe. It's great to have you on the show, Rick.
Thank you for having me.
So the book, you know, it's funny because I looked up the definition of Black Ops and the sense of like it's deception to conceal, but it's different than secret. It's the idea of making it appear that someone else is behind something. It's beyond just secret, right? It's like false flag. Talk a little bit about just the idea of what Black Ops is, and then we'll, you know, talk about sort of what you did.
Well, Scott, that's pretty good. That was a pretty good actual description of it. You know, we are The oversight of the agency is substantial, and things like black ops have to have a presidential finding that is signed by the president of the United States, and that's not delegatable. So black ops are when you carry a mission on behalf of the U.S. government and you hide the American hand. Ideally, even the operation gets hit. I had one of those in Nicaragua where I blew up a port of the Sandinista communist with some of my divers. And lucky for us, the Nicaraguans shut it down from the media. So very little got out. And that's a great op because we didn't get any political blowback. And they could even complain because they didn't want their people to see how vulnerable they really were now. So that's what black ops are, just doing things that you either, you know, attributed to somebody else or they don't know who the heck did it.
And how, I mean, I know every mission has to be different and operation has to be different, but these are months and years in the planning sometimes, or sometimes you've got to act quickly and throw a plan together, you know, at the drop of a hat.
Yes, to both. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you take a long-term one. I'll give you an example. I'm a plank owner of the Bin Laden station. You know, we opened up the Bin Laden Task Force in late 1995, early 1996, and I was the senior operations officer in the unit. And we planned and we proposed. We had Bin Laden in our sights in the mid-90s, to the point that we knew what car he drove, where he drove it, bodyguards. And we kept putting proposals for taking him out. I mean, by taking him out, I don't mean just shooting him. I'm saying we could have gone in there and captured him and brought him out because we knew what he was doing. He was building terrorist camps. He was bringing in Chechens and all kinds of really radical individuals. We had years of that. And how many years later were we able to get Bin Laden himself when we, you know, found out where he was and got our SEAL team guys to shoot him in the face. So, you know, some of them take the span of years and with many steps along the way, but we also have stuff that happens like now, you know, and you have to go in there and come up with ideas and based on experience, we tend to do a very good job of it.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's essential. And so on the Bin Laden, front, were you on the ground there with a black ops operation, or you were not black ops at that point? And how sophisticated was he? Was he a tough guy to figure out in terms of, you know, his movements and his you know, building these networks and all of that?
Well, I have been in the field doing, you know, anti-Bin Laden work numerous times. But in Sudan itself, where he was at the time, we had a group of folks on the ground led by a legendary Green Beret called Billy Wall. He's 92 years old now. But he had the first photographs that we had of Bin Laden, he took from a hideout. And, you know, we could have had him and we should have had him. But the operations were black. We were proposing black operations. At that time, I was managing them, not necessarily at the pointy end, but subsequently, yes, in at least six or seven occasions, I was overseas trying to work against them.
And what was was it that you just weren't given the go-ahead by the higher-ups to pull the trigger, so to speak?
The political will wasn't there, Scott. You know, you had, we had ideas. We knew what he was doing. It was obvious we had overhead of the camps that he was building. The kind of training they were doing was in terrorist attacks. That were, you know, the kind of stuff that you see terrorist training anywhere. And instead of us being able to go in there and take him, you know, neutralizing him in whichever way, we missed the opportunity to stop the cold bombing from happening. The two embassies in Africa that were blown up, not to mention 9/11. When we got hit in our own backyard here. So it's like the old, what would happen if, you know, somebody would have shot Hitler in 1938,
right?
You know, what kind of world would we have? So it's a similar thing. And I hope that it's a lesson learned here that bad guys are bad guys and you need to deal with them, and sweeping it under the rug is going to make you bleed.
Yeah. And look, we're, seeing it right now with the Russia's invasion of the Ukraine. And, you know, some people argue you got to stop him now. Either you want World War III now or you want it in 3 years when he goes into NATO countries. You know, I mean, this guy, I think we've gone too soft with him, but you know, that's, you know, it's funny because it was Bin Laden. Is there anybody that you, so when you're Black Ops, are you in a sense undercover? Are you becoming one of these people? Are you becoming, you know, an Islamic individual, speaking the language and all of that? Or are you just operating as an American operative under the cover of something?
Both, actually. We have individuals like myself who are native Spanish speakers. That's why I was in Nicaragua, because I could pull it off of being a Honduran intelligence major. But we you know, sometimes are you're just doing operations that are like, let's say you're bugging a terrorist safe house, which I did, and it's in the book in one of our Latin American countries. Yes, I was there with the U.S. embassy, but I hadn't bathed for 3 days and grew a beard so I could blend in into that neighborhood to do you know, the break it in and the accompanying audio testing that needs to be done in order to have a successful bug in somebody's house. So yeah, we have individuals that speak native Arabic. We have people speak native Chinese, Farsi. You know, so those people can pull it off. And if they can't pull it off completely, they could pull it off not being an American. So let them think that you're some other Westerner. But yeah,
as long as they don't think you're American, right? So that's sort of their radar goes up. What is it that we being a layperson, just an average American citizen, don't understand about Black Ops, right? There's all sorts of movies and, you know, all of that. And it's romanticized, but what is the reality of that world that you lived in? And was there a particular moment where you misjudged something or miscalculated, or the things went sideways and you were almost, you know, you were almost a dead man? Have you had any of those moments?
Well, starting from there backwards, there was an incident described in the book, and when I went to rescue some of my guys who had been stranded in a mission in the Nicaraguan waters, that were literally on ground and on the water, and that was an operation that went completely wrong. Everything that we had planned, boats broke down, you name it. The Sandinistas got wind of it; they were looking for us, and I told my bosses, "I'm not leaving my guys in there." So I went in with a couple of guys and we were able to get them out. But that's, you know, that's a failed mission, but at least we got our guys out and we didn't lose anybody. But, you know, the bottom line for us is the movies portray the CIA in a very, very bad light, because that's what sells. So we're the most maligned and misunderstood agency of the federal government, you know, and my guys and gals are always described as, you know, maniacal assassins and, you know, treacherous individuals. Movies like Jason Bourne and American Made that are absolute garbage. You know, we do not have a genetically enhanced, you know, psycho
assassin squad. There's not an assassin squad sitting there ready to go with a push of a button and all of that nonsense, right?
No, we have the capability to carry out any operation that the U.S. president, U.S. government does, but those take planning. And I will tell you, the morality inside the agency is the reason I wrote this book. I needed to honor the 137 men and women that we have on the stars on the wall unanimously, for the most part, who have given their lives for this country. And for people to read, see a movie, and then talk about, oh, Mike Spann, well, he was one of those maniacal assassins, or Jennifer Matthews. People that I knew personally that got killed there, I felt that I needed to document what the real CIA was about, and most importantly, what the real ethos is of our personnel.
Mm. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me that, you know, Hollywood takes a lot of liberties with, you know, I mean, I guess we shouldn't know a lot about this, because that's the point of this, right? Like, if we did know a lot about what was happening, then you guys wouldn't be doing your job that well. But so you do have to operate in the shadows.
Well, Yes and no. But here's again the purpose of the book. Mm. And my book is fully cleared by the agency. They scrutinized it and everything that's there. And there's a lot there that they left me do because I spoke to them and I said, this is our responsibility to clear the name and honor the names of our fallen in our operations officers and the sacrifices that they make. Mm. So for us, people need to know what we can let them know. Mm. When we have successes, we may not be able to brag about them for 10 years.
Right.
But at the end of 10 years, when those operations are no longer applicable, expose them, allow them to be told, because unfortunately, that vacuum that we have between what happens and what is leaked, Hollywood fills in that vacuum with all this garbage, and that is criminal. What I don't want is a son going to his mother and father and saying, "Daddy, Daddy, Mom, I want to be a CIA agent," and they go, "Oh, we got to put this kid in therapy because he wants to be Jason Bourne."
Right.
Nothing further from the truth.
Right. How are Black Ops in the Cold War era, how were they different than they are now, which I'll call the age of terrorism? Or are they? What adjustments have had to be made over the years, if any?
Well, terrorism, yeah. Terrorism was a major change for the whole community, but definitely for the CIA. We worked the Cold War was primarily, you worked it out of a U.S. Embassy under some kind of cover, DOD, the Department of Defense, or state, or out of some business that was created for your cover. And it was meeting people and recruiting people and handling people that would give us information. We recruit for strengths, people that are compatible in ideology with us that want to help bigger mm-hmm. picture. And that was the Cold War. We are running assets in some of these countries like China and Russia and all these other places. We did that. And that is a form of black operations. Black operations means you're doing something so deep in the shadows that if you're discovered, our country is embarrassed.
When you say running assets, so let's say you get set up with a quote unquote private company that's a contractor in Russia, but really it's a CIA operation, and you're going to start to work assets and maybe bring some people. This is during the Cold War on our side of the fence. How do you, what, explain to people about the process of running an asset? So you make initial contact with somebody that you think might be susceptible to our way of thinking, and you may need information from that person, and you may have something on them that forces them to give you information. How does that asset get developed?
Well, very good question, and very well planted too. You know your stuff. First of all, when we don't call ourselves agents, we are operations officers.
Okay.
We call the people that we recruit, we call them either assets or agents. So for a CIA agent is actually a foreign national that works for the United States government via the CIA. So the MO is someone like what you explained there. We go out, we meet people in the circles that we can gain access to, and we look for that individual that we say, this person believes like I believe. Before we're lunch, that person says he's tired of the corruption in this country, the fact that we don't have an opposition, that this guy's been in power. When you hear that, those are clues that this individual who has access to intelligence, we don't recruit somebody just for the grins of recruiting somebody. They have to provide us with something of value. Then we just develop them into the point that they trust us enough that we could sit down and close the door and say, hey, this is who I really am, and this is what I need you to help me with. And most of the time, we're successful.
And at the point where you feel comfortable to broach that subject, I would imagine you got a very high hit rate, right? Very high success rate in the sense of like the person agrees, right? Like I would imagine you're so thorough and so experienced
exactly.
that you rarely exactly. get surprised yeah. at somebody's response, right?
Very, very, very seldom, because we, first of all, you know, the scrutiny of any case is managed by our chief of station and even headquarters. They watch out for counterintelligence angles or everything else. But yeah, there is a very sophisticated, counterintuitive, very sophisticated process by where we meet folks, we recruit them, We run them and we test them. You know, we make sure that they're being legit to us in several ways. That, you know, there's a story in the book about it, but I can't talk much more than that.
How do you test somebody? What's an example of how you in the past tested somebody?
Well, let me put an example to you. Let's say that I know the answer to what it is your management chain in your radio station, and I ask you, hey, so what is your bosses like? Who are they? And you give me names that don't match what I already know. So it's the same thing with a government asset. Somebody that is giving information on something, the best interrogation question is the one you know the answer to.
It's exactly like a lawyer in a courtroom. You never ask a question you don't know the answer to.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you have to be really good psychologically with people, right? I mean, there's a lot of hats you have to wear in this position, because you've got to be a people person. You've got to be persuasive. You've got to be able to read people. That stuff is innate, right? You can't really be trained to have those skill sets,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. You know, the agency has a criteria for recruiting, and it's difficult because, for example, you know, I came from the special military kind of a house. Well, special military does not get hired by their charm. Okay, they're not, you know, they're not brought into a team like SEAL teams or pararescue or Delta or Green Berets. And because you're such a great conversationalist and you speak, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So we hire these guys for a different mission. And then from there, we select those that happen to have the education, the background, and that people skills that you alluded to be able to make friends and to be able to fit in and to be able to, you know, for me, you know, I after a while, I became as comfortable sleeping in a jungle hammock in the Nicaraguan jungles for 3 years as I did being a first secretary in Country X, which I did several times, including chief of station. So part of it is the raw talent. We really look for that, but we develop it quite a bit. We invest a lot in development through training, and especially languages. The agency is extremely dependent on our ability to communicate in the local language. We will not deploy somebody to a foreign country unless he or she has at least a 3-level of that particular language.
And how do you sleep at night? How do you get a good night's sleep when you're out in the field doing this kind of thing and not worry that even though you've dotted all your I's and crossed all your T's and you're great at what you do, that somebody doesn't find you out and a rocket launcher comes, you know, come flying through your window.
And it has happened. We have, you know, we got 137 stars on our wall.
Yeah.
And some of those were kinetic reactions, but you know,
what do you mean kinetic reaction? What do you mean by that?
What we're doing. You cannot go in harm's way and do a mission if you don't believe that you're doing the right thing.
But how do you not worry? Don't you go to bed worrying when, I mean, like,
nope.
Obviously, you're in the moment, you're in the field, you've got everything covered.
Like a baby.
Wow.
I slept like a baby because I was living the life that I wanted to live and making the difference that few other people were willing to try to make.
Yeah.
So by believing in what you're doing, you know, I think that that steals you to develop the courage and then the professionalism. I mean, I cross all the I's and dot all the T's, right? And if something happens, well, there's nothing I can do. But that's the exception. For the most part, we're successful because we do sweat the details. But the bottom line is what drives us is the fact that we are in a world that we could make a difference in, and that it's not adventurism, it's actually for a higher cause and a higher purpose.
Yeah, I mean, it's that makes a lot of sense. And I'm fascinated by this, you know, one of your more dangerous missions where you reestablished an abandoned CIA station inside in a fight against the Islamic terrorism. How did you do that? Can you talk about that a little bit and sort of what that involved and how you were able to do that?
I'm not allowed to mention the name of the country. So in the book, we call it Shangri-La. but it was a radical Muslim regime full of terrorists. As a matter of fact, the whole country was pretty much a hotel for terrorists with the kind of individuals that they were harboring there for money. They literally would provide protection just like a mob guy would do. You know, hey, you got protection. Nobody's going to touch you because they were paying. So that mission had been closed down, and we had a logistical team primarily to go in. And then we went operational, and what we were doing in that country was trying to find and geolocate terrorist targets in case we needed to act upon them. And for example, we may have a signal intelligence piece of intelligence that says, hey, you know, this guy is living somewhere in this area and he's driving a red car. And then overhead says, hey, in this area, there's 5 red cars. And then we go in disguise in non-diplomatic vehicles at night, armed for bear, and we would try to geolocate. When we found, okay, these are the 5 red cars in this neighborhood, you take a GPS hit, and then you do more sleuth hunt work and you try to narrow it down. So eventually you can pinpoint something. Like in the case of Bin Laden, we eventually were able to geolocate him and have our SEAL team guys shoot him.
And on that red car, at that point, you find the car. Do you destroy the car and then slip back into the night?
No. On the contrary, what we're looking is for threads that lead us to the individual so we can, rendition them or get them arrested or whatever the mission happens to be.
Got it.
So it is a sleuth hound kind of operation where you're putting little pieces together and allowing the bigger machinery back at headquarters with the NSA and everybody else to try to find those puzzle pieces in case we needed to go in there and stop something from happening.
It's an incredible amount of coordination, you know, with so many moving parts. It's amazing. Well, I thank you for your service. It's a really important job that you do and these folks have done. And I'm glad you wrote the book, Black Ops, The Life of a CIA Shadow Warrior. It's really great to have you on, Rick. I love stuff like this because it gives you a real window into how things actually work as opposed to the perceptions that get created. So I applaud you for the book.
Thank you. That's the purpose of the book. And I think we succeeded in doing so. Thank you very much for having me on.
Absolutely.
All right. That was Rick Prado. Really, really amazing guy and amazing life. And so cool to hear about that world of CIA Black Ops. Hope you enjoyed it. And please remember, go review the podcast and tell your friends about it. And we will see you next week, everybody.